Hey, folks, Attorney Andrew Branca here for the Law of Self-Defense. Thank you so much for joining me. And what we'll be doing in today's show is to begin a reading of the famous U.S. Supreme Court case, Miranda v. Arizona, handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1966. Now, this will be a four-part reading. It's a very long decision. It took me a couple of hours more to read through the entire thing. So we'll have four parts. The first two parts will be the majority opinion, part one and part two. And the second two parts will be the several dissents, three dissents, also as a part one and part two. Now, this was a 5-4 decision, a very close call, as close as you can get from the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's certainly wasn't obvious at the time that our Miranda rules, which I'll go over in a moment, but you're all familiar with from movies and TVs, were to be a thing. Before this decision, they weren't a thing, certainly not nationwide. The FBI had begun to use a version of what we now call Miranda itself, but local law enforcement was under no particular obligation to read anybody their rights before they started an interrogation. And that's what Miranda is really all about. It's the reading to a suspect of his rights before he can be subject to in-custody interrogation. That's what the case is all about. Now, it's important to note that Miranda was an individual, Ernesto Miranda. We'll talk about him more in a moment. He had been arrested, subject to interrogation, gave a confession without, of course, having been read his Miranda rights, which didn't exist at the time. His confession was introduced as evidence against him at trial, and he was convicted. And in Miranda v. Arizona, one of the outcomes is that that conviction is overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court on the grounds that he should have been read Miranda rights that didn't exist at the time. There were, however, also three other cases involved in this U.S. Supreme Court of Miranda v. Arizona. They're not in the title or citation of the decision, but they are discussed over the course of this case. So the U.S. Supreme Court had basically aggregated together four separate cases as part of their analysis and decision in Miranda v. Arizona. Now, about Miranda specifically, both the decision and the man. So again, this was a 5-4 Supreme Court decision handed down in 1966, and it ruled that an arrested individual is entitled to rights against self-incrimination and to an attorney under the Fifth and Sixth Amendments of the United States. Fifth Amendment, right to not incriminate yourself, not be compelled to incriminate yourself. And the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Now, before Miranda, you had these rights, but they typically applied only at trial. They didn't apply pre-trial. In particular, they didn't apply in the investigatory or interrogation stage of an investigation. That's what Miranda changed. So at trial, you already had a recognized right that you could not be compelled to testify against yourself, and you had a recognized right to counsel at trial. What Miranda changed was it applied those rights to the interrogation stage of the investigation. So on March 13th, 1963, police arrested Ernesto Miranda on charges of rape and kidnapping after he was identified by a witness. This is in Phoenix, Arizona. And he was subject to a 2-hour interrogation, during which, of course, the police did not advise Miranda of his Miranda rights. There were no Miranda rights yet. So they did not advise Miranda on his constitutional rights to an attorney or against self-incrimination. And he ultimately signed a written confession, acknowledging knowledge of these rights and admitting to crimes. Now, this written acknowledgement of his rights was really just boilerplate on the form. So it's the Supreme Court certainly did not believe that he'd knowingly, intelligently waived his rights here. This confession that he gave was introduced into evidence at court, and on June 27th, 1963, just a couple months later, he was convicted of rape and kidnapping, and also robbery. The judge sentenced Miranda to a maximum 55 years in prison, and Miranda's lawyer appealed the case to the Arizona Supreme Court. The Arizona Supreme Court reaffirmed the lower court's decision, arguing that the police had not violated Miranda's constitutional rights in obtaining a confession from him without the presence of a lawyer. From there, it went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court, on June 13th, 1966, reversed Miranda's conviction. It held that presenting Miranda's confession, the confession obtained without him being informed of his rights, as evidence at his trial, violated his constitutional rights under the Fifth Amendment to not be compelled to incriminate yourself, and the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Now, of course, Miranda was not beaten to get a confession out of him, which would be an obvious violation of his Fifth Amendment rights. But what the Supreme Court does here in Miranda is hold that the in-custody environment of an interrogation imposes implicit coercion onto the suspect. And that's why their rights need to be read to him, even in the absence of physical coercion. The U.S. Supreme Court, in this Miranda decision, ruled that the Fifth Amendment protects from self-incrimination and requires the police, for the first time ever, requires the police to inform the suspect about his rights, while the Sixth Amendment guarantees the suspect a right to a personal or state-issued attorney. This whole state-issued attorney, by the way, an attorney would be provided if you can't afford one. That was also recent law. That was a decision just a few years before. The result of several decisions just before Miranda. This was part of the Warren Court. The Warren Court, Chief Justice Earl Warren, was a very activist Chief Justice on the Supreme Court. Lots of criminal law changed during the 60s in America and the 70s. Chief Justice Earl Warren articulated that the court permitted confession or self-incriminating statements in criminal trials only. So it was only admissible in evidence when the suspects who made those confessions were deliberately informed of their rights, explicitly informed of their rights, that this was documented and that they explicitly waived their rights and this was documented. There were, again, four dissenters, so a 5-4 decision, and the four dissenters in a variety of combinations wrote three dissenting opinions, and I'll cover those in the third and fourth parts of this reading of Miranda. So, interesting, a little history on this. After Arizona's ruling was overturned, the conviction of Miranda was overturned by this Supreme Court decision, the trial court again retried the case without presenting Miranda's purportedly coerced confession into evidence. So the jury never saw the confession in his retrial. And that jury in the retrial convicted him on the same charges. And he was sentenced to a maximum 30 years in prison. He didn't do 30 years in prison, though. Remarkably enough, he was released from prison after only 5 years. And guess what happened to him then? Well, 4 years after that release, on parole, Miranda was murdered. He was murdered, stabbed to death by a man who, when that killer was arrested, the killer of Miranda was arrested, he got read his Miranda rights. What are those Miranda rights? One, you have the right to remain silent. Two, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. Three, you have a right to an attorney and for the attorney to be present during interrogation. Four, if you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed for you. Those are the four Miranda rights that are famously known to most of us simply through watching police dramas on TV and in the movies. So, what else did I want to say about that? I guess I would only add, be sure you listen to the dissents, not just the majority that I'm reading here. So not just parts one and two, but also parts three or four. And in every of the four parts I'm reading, I'll, of course, put links to the others. But you ought naturally start at part one right here. Because the dissents are very helpful in understanding the broader context of this ruling and the state of criminal law in the United States at the time. Again, dissents are very helpful for sharing the other side of the argument, the losing side of the argument. But just because it lost doesn't mean it doesn't have merit. Remember, these are four Supreme Court justices disagreeing with this ruling on requiring Miranda rights, Miranda warnings for in-custody interrogations. So gives you that other perspective. And yeah, it was a very close call. Again, 5-4 decision. It's quite possible, you know, one justice rules the other way, and we haven't had Miranda rights for the last 60, 70 years in America. All right, folks. So with that out of the way, I'm going to jump right into part one of four, reading the first half of the majority opinion. Enjoy. Today's show is sponsored by the Law of Self-Defense, specifically our advanced live online class taking place on April 20th, 2024. This is our full day course on use of force law that makes you hard to convict if you're ever compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, or your property. We cover everything you need to know, why and how the legal system prosecutes self-defense, the five elements of self-defense, the fundamental building blocks of any claim of self-defense. We cover defense of others and defense of property, consciousness of guilt, self-defense immunity. We spend almost an hour talking about interacting with the police in the aftermath of a use of force event, how to craft your own customized, legally sound self-defense strategy, and much, much more. Now, we only teach this class twice a year at most. So if you miss this April course, it'll be at least 6 months before you have the opportunity to take this course again and make yourself hard to convict. Do you know when you're going to be attacked? It's not up to you. The bad guy chooses the time, place, and manner of attack. You need to be ready for both the physical fight and the legal fight before that happens. And register now, and you can get up to 50% off for this April 20th Law of Self-Defense live online advanced course. Don't hesitate. Scan that QR code now or simply visit lawofselfdefense.com/advanced. And now, folks, let's begin. Let's begin with our reading of Miranda v. Arizona. Right here. Oops. 384 U.S. 436 is the site. U.S. Supreme Court, 1966. It was decided on June 13th, 1966. I'm going to skip the syllabus. By the way, you can find this decision at lawofselfdefense.com/Miranda. So you can read all this extra stuff if you want. The syllabus is not a formal part of the opinion. Counsel, lots of counsel. This is a very high-profile case, of course. And the judges, Warren, Black, Douglas, Clark, Harlan, Brennan, Stewart, White, Fortas. The majority opinion was Warren, Black, Douglas, Brennan, Fortas. Warren, of course, was the Chief Justice. That's five justices. And the dissent was four. Clark, in part, Harlan, White, and Stewart. So a 5-4 decision. Miranda, U.S. v. Miranda, or rather, Miranda v. Arizona. Miranda v. Arizona. So, opinion written by Chief Justice Warren. The cases before us, and remember, they're actually looking at four cases involving this issue of Miranda rights. So they've combined them all into this one Miranda v. Arizona decision. The cases before us raise questions which go to the roots of our concepts of American criminal jurisprudence, the restraints society must observe consistent with the federal Constitution in prosecuting individuals for crime. More specifically, we deal with the admissibility of statements obtained from an individual who was subjected to custodial police interrogation and the necessity for procedures which assure that individual is accorded his privilege under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution not to be compelled to incriminate himself. We dealt with certain phases of this problem recently in Escobedo v. Illinois, a decision decided 2 years earlier. There, as in the four cases before us, law enforcement officials took the defendant into custody and interrogated him in a police station for the purpose of obtaining a confession. The police did not effectively advise him of his right to remain silent or of his right to consult with his attorney. Rather, they confronted him with an alleged accomplice who accused him of having perpetrated a murder. When the defendant denied the accusation and said, "I didn't shoot Manuel, you did," they handcuffed him and took him to an interrogation room. There, while handcuffed and standing, he was questioned for 4 hours until he confessed. During this interrogation, the police denied his request to speak to his attorney, and they prevented his retained attorney, who had come to the police station, from consulting with him. At his trial, the state, over his objection, introduced the confession against him. We held that the statements thus made were constitutionally inadmissible as evidence. This case has been the subject of judicial interpretation and spirited legal debate since it was decided 2 years ago, meaning Escobedo. Both state and federal courts, in assessing its implications, have arrived at varying conclusions. A wealth of scholarly material has been written tracing its ramifications and underpinnings. Police and prosecutor have speculated on its range and desirability. We granted certiorari in these cases in order to further explore some facets of the problems thus exposed of applying the privilege against self-incrimination to in-custody interrogation and to give concrete constitutional guidelines for law enforcement agencies and courts to follow. So I'll interrupt just for a moment. So traditionally, the right to not be compelled to testify against yourself applied at trial, but not pretrial, and not during the investigative stage. Back to the opinion. We start here, as we did in Escobedo, with the premise that our holding is not an innovation in our jurisprudence, but is an application of principles long recognized and applied in other settings. We have undertaken a thorough re-examination of the Escobedo decision and the principles it announced, and we reaffirm it. That case was but an explication of basic rights that are enshrined in our Constitution, that, quote, no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, close quote, and that, quote, the accused shall have the assistance of counsel, close quote. Again, both the right against self-incrimination and the right to counsel, folks, was traditionally in the trial setting, not the pretrial setting, not the investigative setting. That's what's new here. Continuing with the opinion, right not to be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, and the accused should have the assistance of counsel, rights which were put in jeopardy in that case, Escobedo, through official overbearing. These precious rights were fixed in our Constitution only after centuries of persecution and struggle. And in the words of Chief Justice Marshall, they were secured for ages to come and designed to approach immortality as nearly as human institutions can approach it. Over 70 years ago, our predecessors on this court eloquently stated, quote, the maxim nemo tenetur se ipsum accusari had its origin in a protest against the inquisitorial and manifestly unjust methods of interrogating accused persons which have long obtained in the continental system, and until the expulsion of the Stuarts from the British throne in 1688 and the erection of additional barriers for the protection of the people against the exercise of arbitrary power, were not uncommon even in England. While the admissions or confessions of the prisoner, when voluntarily and freely made, have always ranked high in the scale of incriminating evidence, if an accused person be asked to explain his apparent connection with a crime under investigation, the ease with which the questions put to him may assume an inquisitorial character. The temptation to press the witness unduly, to browbeat him if he be timid or reluctant, to push him into a corner, and to entrap him into fatal contradictions, which are so painfully evident in many of the earlier state trials, notably in those of Sir Nicholas Throckmorton and Udall, the Puritan minister, made the system so odious as to give rise to a demand for its total abolition. The change in the English criminal procedure in that particular seems to be founded upon no statute and no judicial opinion, but upon a general and silent acquiescence of the courts in a popular demand. But however adopted, it has become firmly embedded in English as well as in American jurisprudence. So deeply did the inequities of the ancient system impress themselves upon the minds of the American colonists that the states, with one accord, made a denial of the right to question an accused person a part of their fundamental law, so that a maxim, which in England was a mere rule of evidence, became clothed in this country, America, with the impregnability of a constitutional enactment. Close quote. In stating the obligation of the judiciary to apply these constitutional rights, this court, the Supreme Court, declared in Weems v. United States in 1910, quote, our contemplation cannot be only of what has been, but of what may be. Under any other rule, a constitution would indeed be as easy of application as it would be deficient in efficacy and power. Its general principles would have little value and be converted by precedent into impotent and lifeless formulas. Rights declared in words might be lost in reality, and this has been recognized. The meaning and vitality of the constitution have developed against narrow and restrictive construction. Close quote. This was the spirit in which we delineated in meaningful language the manner in which the constitutional rights of the individual could be enforced against overzealous police practices. It was necessary in Escobedo, as here, to ensure that what was proclaimed in the Constitution had not become but a form of words in the hands of government officials. And it is in this spirit, consistent with our role as judges, that we adhere to the principles of Escobedo today. Our holding will be spelled out with some specificity in the pages which follow, but briefly stated, it is this. The prosecution may not use statements, whether exculpatory or inculpatory, stemming from custodial interrogation of the defendant, unless it demonstrates the use of procedural safeguards effective to secure the privilege against self-incrimination. By custodial interrogation, we mean questioning initiated by law enforcement officers after a person has been taken into custody or otherwise deprived of his freedom of action in any significant way. As for the procedural safeguards to be employed, unless other fully effective means are devised to inform accused persons of the right of silence and to assure a continuous opportunity to exercise it, the following measures are required. Prior to any questioning, the person must be warned that he has a right to remain silent, that any statement he does make may be used as evidence against him, and that he has a right to the presence of an attorney, either retained or appointed. The defendant may waive effectuation of these rights, provided the waiver is made voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently. If, however, he indicates in any manner and at any stage of the process that he wishes to consult with an attorney before speaking, there can be no questioning. Likewise, if the individual is alone and indicates in any manner that he does not wish to be interrogated, the police may not question him. The mere fact that he may have answered some questions or volunteered some statements on his own does not deprive him of the right to refrain from answering any further inquiries until he has consulted with an attorney and thereafter consents to be questioned. Section 1. The constitutional issue we decide in each of these cases is the admissibility of statements obtained from a defendant questioned while in custody or otherwise deprived of his freedom of action in any significant way. In each, the defendant was questioned by police officers, detectives, or a prosecuting attorney in a room in which he was cut off from the outside world. In none of these cases was the defendant given a full and effective warning of his rights at the outset of the interrogation process. In all the cases, the questioning elicited oral admissions, and in three of them, signed statements as well, which were admitted at their trials. They all thus share salient features. Incommunicado interrogation of individuals in a police-dominated atmosphere, resulting in self-incriminating statements without full warnings of constitutional rights. An understanding of the nature and setting of this in-custody interrogation is essential to our decisions today. The difficulty in depicting what transpires at such interrogations stems from the fact that in this country they have largely taken place incommunicado. From extensive factual studies undertaken in the early 1930s, including the famous Wickersham Report to Congress by a presidential commission, it is clear that police violence and the third degree flourished at that time. In a series of cases decided by this court long after these studies, the police resorted to physical brutality, beating, hanging, whipping, and to sustained and protracted questioning incommunicado in order to extort confessions. The Commission on Civil Rights in 1961 found much evidence to indicate that some policemen still resort to physical force to obtain confessions. The use of physical brutality and violence is not, unfortunately, relegated to the past or to any part of the country. Only recently, in Kings County, New York, the police brutally beat, kicked, and placed lighted cigarette butts on the back of a potential witness under interrogation for the purpose of securing a statement incriminating a third party. The examples given above are undoubtedly the exception now, but they are sufficiently widespread to be the object of concern. Unless a proper limitation upon custodial interrogation is achieved, such as these decisions will advance, there can be no assurance that practices of this nature will be eradicated in the foreseeable future. The conclusion of the Wickersham Commission report made over 30 years ago is still pertinent. Quote, to the contention that the third degree is necessary to get the facts, the reporters aptly reply in the language of the present Lord Chancellor of England, Lord Sankey. Another insert quote, it is not admissible to do a great right by doing a little wrong. It is not sufficient to do justice by obtaining a proper result by irregular or improper means. Close the insert quote. Not only does the use of the third degree involve a flagrant violation of law by the officers of the law, but it involves also the dangers of false confessions and it tends to make police and prosecutors less zealous in the search for objective evidence. As the New York prosecutor quoted in the report said, it is a shortcut and makes the police lazy and unenterprising. Or, as another official quoted remarked, if you use your fists, you are not so likely to use your wits. We agree with the conclusion expressed in the report that the third degree brutalizes the police, hardens the prisoner against society, and lowers the esteem in which the administration of justice is held by the public. Close quote. Back to the opinion, Miranda v. Arizona. Again, we stress that the modern practice of in-custody interrogation is psychologically rather than physically oriented. As we have stated before, quote, since Chambers v. Florida, this court has recognized that coercion can be mental as well as physical, and that the blood of the accused is not the only hallmark of an unconstitutional inquisition. Close quote. Interrogation still takes place in privacy. Privacy results in secrecy, and this in turn results in a gap in our knowledge as to what in fact goes on in the interrogation rooms. A valuable source of information about present police practices, however, may be found in various police manuals and texts which document procedures employed with success in the past and which recommend various other effective tactics. These texts are used by law enforcement agencies themselves as guides. It should be noted that these texts professedly present the most enlightened and effective means presently used to obtain statements through custodial interrogation. By considering these texts and other data, it is possible to describe procedures observed and noted around the country. The officers are told by the manuals that the, quote, principal psychological factor contributing to a successful interrogation is privacy, being alone with the person under interrogation, close quote. The efficacy of this tactic has been explained as follows, quote, if at all practicable, the interrogation should take place in the investigator's office, or at least in a room of his own choice. The subject should be deprived of every psychological advantage. In his own home, he may be confident, indignant, or recalcitrant. He is more keenly aware of his rights and more reluctant to tell of his indiscretions or criminal behavior within the walls of his home. Moreover, his family and other friends are nearby, their presence lending moral support. In his own office, the investigator possesses all the advantages. The atmosphere suggests the invincibility of the forces of the law. Close quote. To highlight the isolation and unfamiliar surroundings, the manuals instruct the police to display an air of confidence in the suspect's guilt, and from outward appearance to maintain only an interest in confirming certain details. The guilt of the subject is to be posited as a fact. The interrogator should direct his comments toward the reasons why the subject committed the act rather than court failure by asking the subject whether he did it. Like other men, perhaps the subject has had a bad family life, had an unhappy childhood, had too much to drink, had an unrequited desire for women. The officers are instructed to minimize the moral seriousness of the offense, to cast blame on the victim or on society. These tactics are designed to put the subject in a psychological state where his story is but an elaboration of what the police purport to know already, that he is guilty. Explanations to the contrary are dismissed and discouraged. The text thus stressed that the major qualities an interrogator should possess are patience and perseverance. One writer describes the efficacy of these characteristics in this manner. Quote, in the preceding paragraphs, emphasis has been placed on kindness and stratagems. The investigator will, however, encounter many situations where the sheer weight of his personality will be the deciding factor. Where emotional appeals and tricks are employed to no avail, he must rely on an oppressive atmosphere of dogged persistence. He must interrogate steadily and without relent, leaving the subject no prospect of surcease. He must dominate his subject and overwhelm him with his inexorable will to obtain the truth. He should interrogate for a spell of several hours, pausing only for the subject's necessities in acknowledgement of the need to avoid a charge of duress that can be technically substantiated. In a serious case, the interrogation may continue for days, with the required intervals for food and sleep, but with no respite from the atmosphere of domination. It is possible in this way to induce the subject to talk without resorting to duress or coercion. The method should be used only when the guilt of the subject appears highly probable. Close quote. The manual suggests that the suspect be offered legal excuses for his actions in order to obtain an initial admission of guilt. Where there is a suspected revenge killing, for example, the interrogator may say, quote, "Joe, you probably didn't go out looking for this fellow with the purpose of shooting him. My guess is, however, that you expected something from him, and that's why you carried a gun, for your own protection. You knew him for what he was, no good. Then when you met him, he probably started using foul, abusive language, and he gave some indication that he was about to pull a gun on you. And that's when you had to act to save your own life. That's about it, isn't it, Joe?" Close quote. Having then obtained the admission of shooting, the interrogator is advised to refer to circumstantial evidence which negates the self-defense explanation. This should enable him to secure the entire story. One text notes that, quote, "Even if he fails to do so, the inconsistency between the subject's original denial of the shooting and his present admission of at least doing the shooting will serve to deprive him of a self-defense out at the time of trial." Close quote. When the techniques described above prove unavailing, the text recommend they be alternated with a show of some hostility. One ploy often used has been termed the, quote, "friendly unfriendly," or the, quote, "Mutt and Jeff Act." Quote, "In this technique, two agents are employed. Mutt, the relentless investigator, who knows the subject is guilty and is not going to waste any time. He's sent a dozen men away for this crime, and he's going to send the subject away for the full term. Jeff, on the other hand, is obviously a kind-hearted man. He is a family himself. He is a brother who is involved in a little scrape like this. He disapproves of Mutt and his tactics and will arrange to get him off the case if the subject will cooperate. But he can't hold Mutt off for very long. The subject would be wise to make a quick decision." The technique is applied by having both investigators present while Mutt acts out his role. Jeff may stand by quality and demur at some of Mutt's tactics. When Jeff makes his plea for cooperation, Mutt is not present in the room. Close quote. The interrogators sometimes are instructed to induce a confession out of trickery. The technique here is quite effective in crimes which require identification or which run in series. In the identification situation, the interrogator may take a break in his questioning to place the subject among a group of men in a lineup. Quote, "The witness or complainant, previously coached if necessary, studies the lineup and confidently points out the subject as the guilty party." Close quote. Then the questioning resumes, quote, "as though there were now no doubt about the guilt of the subject." Close quote. A variation on this technique is called the reverse lineup. Quote, "The accused is placed in a lineup, but this time he is identified by several fictitious witnesses or victims who associated him with different offenses. It is expected that the subject will become desperate and confess to the offense under investigation in order to escape from the false accusations." Close quote. The manuals also contain instructions for police on how to handle the individual who refuses to discuss the matter entirely or who asks for an attorney or relatives. The examiner is to concede him the right to remain silent. Quote, "This usually has a very undermining effect. First of all, the suspect is disappointed in his expectation of an unfavorable reaction on the part of the interrogator. Secondly, A concession of this right to remain silent impresses the subject with the apparent fairness of his interrogator. Close quote. After the psychological conditioning, however, the officer is told to point out the incriminating significance of the suspect's refusal to talk. Quote, Joe, you have a right to remain silent. That's your privilege, and I'm the last person in the world who'll try to take that away from you. If that's the way you want to leave this, okay. But let me ask you this. Suppose you were in my shoes, and I were in yours, and you called me in to ask me about this, and I told you, I don't want to answer any of your questions. You'd think I had something to hide, and you'd probably be right in thinking that. That's exactly what I'll have to think about you, and so will everybody else. So let's sit here and talk this whole thing over. Close quote. Few will persist in their initial refusal to talk, it is said, if this monologue is employed correctly. In the event that the subject wishes to speak to a relative or an attorney, the following advice is tendered. Quote, the interrogator should respond by suggesting that the subject first tell the truth to the interrogator himself rather than get anyone else involved in the matter. If the request is for an attorney, the interrogator may suggest that the subject save himself or his family the expense of any such professional service, particularly if he is innocent of the offense under investigation. The interrogator may also add, Joe, I'm only looking for the truth, and if you're telling the truth, that's it. You can handle this by yourself. Close quote. From these representative samples of interrogation techniques, the setting prescribed by the manuals and observed in practice becomes clear. In essence, it is this. To be alone with the subject is essential to prevent distraction and to deprive him of any outside support. The aura of confidence in his guilt undermines his will to resist. He merely confirms the preconceived story the police seek to have him describe. Patience and persistence, at times relentless questioning, are employed. To obtain a confession, the interrogator must, quote, patiently maneuver himself or his quarry into a position from which the desired objective may be attained, close quote. When normal procedures fail to produce the needed results, the police may resort to deceptive stratagems, such as giving false legal advice. It is important to keep the subject off balance, for example, by trading on his insecurity about himself or his surroundings. The police then persuade, trick, or cajole him out of exercising his constitutional rights. Even without employing brutality, the third degree, or the specific stratagems described above, the very fact of custodial interrogation exacts a heavy toll on individual liberty and trades on the weakness of individuals. This fact may be illustrated simply by referring to three confession cases decided by this court in the term immediately preceding our Escobedo decision. In Townsend v. Sane, decided in 1963, the defendant was a 19-year-old heroin addict described as a near-mental defective. The defendant in Lynham v. Illinois, also 1963, was a woman who confessed to the arresting officer after being importuned to cooperate in order to prevent her children from being taken by relief authorities. This court, as in those cases, reversed the conviction of a defendant in Haynes v. Washington, also 1963, whose persistent request during his interrogation was to phone his wife or attorney. In other settings, these individuals may have exercised their constitutional rights. In the incommunicado police-dominated atmosphere, they succumbed. In the cases before us today, given this background, we concern ourselves primarily with this interrogation atmosphere and the evils it can bring. In case number 759, Miranda v. Arizona, the police arrested the defendant and took him to a special interrogation room where they secured a confession. In case number 760, Vignera v. New York, the defendant made oral admissions to the police after interrogation in the afternoon and then signed an inculpatory statement upon being questioned by an assistant DA later the same evening. In case number 761, Westover v. United States, the defendant was handed over to the Federal Bureau of Investigation by local authorities after they had detained and interrogated him for a lengthy period, both at night and the following morning. After some 2 hours of questioning, the federal officer had obtained signed statements from the defendant. Lastly, in number 584, California v. Stewart, the local police held the defendant 5 days in the station. and interrogated him on 9 separate occasions before they secured his inculpatory statement. In these cases, we might not find the defendant's statements to have been involuntary in traditional terms. Our concern is for adequate safeguards to protect precious Fifth Amendment rights is, of course, not lessened in the slightest. In each of the cases, the defendant was thrust into an unfamiliar atmosphere and run through menacing police interrogation procedures. The potentiality for compulsion is forcefully apparent, for example, in Miranda, where the indigent Mexican defendant was a seriously disturbed individual with pronounced sexual fantasies, and in Stewart, in which the defendant was an indigent Los Angeles Negro who had dropped out of school in the 6th grade. To be sure, the records do not evince overt physical coercion or patent psychological ploys. The fact remains that in none of these cases did the officers undertake to afford appropriate safeguards at the outset of the interrogation to ensure that the statements were truly the product of free choice. It is obvious that such an interrogation environment is created for no purpose other than to subjugate the individual to the will of his examiner. This atmosphere carries its own badge of intimidation. To be sure, this is not physical intimidation, but it is equally destructive of human dignity. The current practice of incommunicado interrogation is at odds with one of our nation's most cherished principles, that the individual may not be compelled to incriminate himself. Unless adequate protective devices are employed to dispel the compulsion inherent in custodial surroundings, no statement obtained from the defendant can truly be the product of his free choice. From the foregoing, we can readily perceive an intimate connection between the privilege against self-incrimination and police custodial questioning. It is fitting to turn to history and precedent underlying the self-incrimination clause to determine its applicability in this situation. Section 2. We sometimes forget how long it has taken to establish the privilege against self-incrimination, the sources from which it came, and the fervor with which it was defended. Its roots go back into ancient times. Perhaps the critical historical event shedding light on its origins and evolution was the trial of one John Lilburn, a vocal anti-Stuart leveler, who was made to take the Star Chamber oath in 1637. The oath would have bound him to answer to all questions posed to him on any subject. He resisted the oath and declaimed the proceeding, stating, quote, "Another fundamental right I then contended for was that no man's conscience ought to be racked by oaths imposed to answer to questions concerning himself in matters criminal or pretended to be so." Close quote. On account of the Lilburn trial, Parliament abolished the inquisitorial court of Star Chamber and went further in giving him generous reparation. The lofty principles to which Lilburn had appealed during his trial gained popular acceptance in England. These sentiments worked their way over to the colonies and were implanted after great struggle into the Bill of Rights. Those who framed our Constitution and the Bill of Rights were ever aware of subtle encroachments on individual liberty. They knew that illegitimate and unconstitutional practices get their first footing by silent approaches and slight deviations from legal modes of procedure. Close quote. That was Boyd v. United States, a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 1886. The privilege was elevated to constitutional status, the privilege not to incriminate yourself, and has always been, quote, "as broad as the mischief against which it seeks to guard," close quote. U.S. Supreme Court, Councilman v. Hitchcock, 1892. The opinion here continues, "We cannot depart from this noble heritage." Thus, we may view the historical development of the privilege as one which groped for the proper scope of governmental power over the citizen. As a, quote, "noble principle often transcends its origins," close quote, the privilege has come rightfully to be recognized in part as an individual's substantive right, a, quote, "right to a private enclave where he may lead a private life. That is the hallmark of our democracy," close quote. U.S. Supreme Court, United States v. Grunwald, 1957, that is a dissent. Continuing with the Miranda v. Arizona, We have recently noted that the privilege against self-incrimination, the essential mainstay of our adversary system, is founded on a complex of values. All these policies point to one overriding thought. The constitutional foundation underlying the privilege is the respect a government, state or federal, must accord to the dignity and integrity of its citizens. To maintain a fair state-individual balance, to require the government to shoulder the entire load, to respect the inviolability of the human personality, our accusatory system of criminal justice demands that the government seeking to punish an individual produce the evidence against him by its own independent labors, rather than by the cruel, simple expedient of compelling it from his own mouth. In sum, the privilege is fulfilled only when the person is guaranteed the right, quote, to remain silent unless he chooses to speak in the unfettered exercise of his own will, close quote. Another Supreme Court decision, Malloy v. Hogan, 1964. Continuing now. The question in these cases is whether the privilege is fully applicable during a period of custodial interrogation. In this Supreme Court, the privilege has consistently been accorded a liberal construction. We are satisfied that all the principles embodied in the privilege apply to informal compulsion exerted by law enforcement officers during in-custody questioning. An individual swept from familiar surroundings into police custody, surrounded by antagonistic forces, and subjected to the techniques of persuasion described above cannot be otherwise than under compulsion to speak. As a practical matter, the compulsion to speak in the isolated setting of the police station may well be greater than in courts or other official investigations, where there are often impartial observers to guard against intimidation or trickery. This question, in fact, could have been taken as settled in federal courts almost 70 years ago, when in Bram v. United States, U.S. Supreme Court, 1897, this Supreme Court held, quote, in criminal trials in the courts of the United States, wherever a question arises whether a confession is incompetent because not voluntary, the issue is controlled by that portion of the Fifth Amendment commanding that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Close quote. In Bram, the Supreme Court reviewed the British and American history and case law and set down the Fifth Amendment standard for compulsion, which we implement today. Quote, quoting now from Bram, much of the confusion which has resulted from the effort to deduce from the adjudged cases what would be a sufficient quantum of proof to show that a confession was or was not voluntary has arisen from a misconception of the subject to which the proof must address itself. The rule is not that in order to render a statement admissible, the proof must be adequate to establish that the particular communications contained in a statement were voluntarily made, but it must be sufficient to establish that the making of the statement was voluntary. That is to say, that from the causes which the law treats as legally sufficient to engender in the mind of the accused hope or fear in respect to the crime charged, the accused was not involuntarily impelled to make a statement, when but for the improper influences, he would have remained silent. Close quote. The Supreme Court has adhered to this reasoning. In 1924, Mr. Justice Brandeis wrote for a unanimous Supreme Court in reversing a conviction resting on a compelled confession, Juan v. State. He, Justice Brandeis, stated, quote, in the federal courts, the requisite of voluntariness is not satisfied by establishing merely that the confession was not induced by a promise or a threat. A confession is voluntary in law if, and only if, it was in fact voluntarily made. A confession may have been given voluntarily, although it was made to police officers while in custody and in answer to an examination conducted by them. But a confession obtained by compulsion must be excluded, whatever may have been the character of the compulsion, and whether the compulsion was applied in a judicial proceeding or otherwise. Close quote. Bram v. United States. In addition to the expansive historical development of the privilege and the sound policies which have nurtured its evolution, judicial precedent thus clearly establishes its application to incommunicado interrogation. In fact, the government concedes this point is well established in case number 761, Westover v. United States, stating, quote, "We have no doubt that it is possible for a suspect's Fifth Amendment right to be violated during in-custody questioning by a law enforcement officer," close quote. Because of the adoption by Congress of Rule 5A of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure and this Supreme Court's effectuation of that rule in McNabb v. United States and Mallory v. United States, we have had little occasion in the past quarter century to reach the constitutional issues in dealing with federal interrogations. These supervisory rules requiring production of an arrested person before a commissioner, quote, "without unnecessary delay," close quote, and excluding evidence obtained in default of that statutory obligation, were nonetheless responsive to the same considerations of Fifth Amendment policy that unavoidably face us now, as to the states. In McNabb and in Mallory, we recognize both the dangers of interrogation and the appropriateness of prophylaxis stemming from the very fact of interrogation itself. Our decision of Molloy v. Hogan, U.S. Supreme Court, 1964, just 2 years before this decision, necessitates an examination of the scope of the privilege in state cases as well. In Molloy, we squarely held the privilege applicable to the states and held that the substantive standards underlying the privilege against self-incrimination applied with full force to state court proceedings. There, we applied the existing Fifth Amendment standards to the case before us. Aside from the holding itself, the reasoning in Molloy made clear what had already become apparent, that the substantive and procedural safeguards surrounding admissibility of confessions in state cases had become exceedingly exacting, reflecting all the policies embedded in the privilege against self-incrimination. The voluntariness doctrine in the state cases, as Molloy indicates, encompasses all interrogation practices which are likely to exert such pressure upon an individual as to disable him from making a free and rational choice. The implications of this proposition were elaborated in our decision in Escobedo v. Illinois, decided 1 week after Molloy applied the privilege to the states. Our holding there stressed the fact that the police had not advised the defendant of his constitutional privilege to remain silent at the outset of the interrogation, and we drew attention to that fact at several points in the decision. This was no isolated factor, but an essential ingredient in our decision. The entire thrust of police interrogation there, as in all the cases today, was to put the defendant in such an emotional state as to impair his capacity for rational judgment. The abdication of the constitutional privilege, the choice on his part to speak to the police, was not made knowingly or competently because of the failure to apprise him of his rights. The compelling atmosphere of the in-custody interrogation, and not an independent decision on his part, caused the defendant to speak. A different phase of the Escobedo decision was significant in its attention to the absence of counsel during questioning. There, as in the cases we're considering today, we sought a protective device to dispel the compelling atmosphere of the interrogation. In Escobedo, however, the police did not relieve the defendant of the anxieties which they had created in the interrogation rooms. Rather, they denied his request for the assistance of counsel. This heightened his dilemma and made his later statements the product of this compulsion. The denial of the defendant's request for his attorney thus undermined his ability to exercise the privilege against self-incrimination, to remain silent if he chose, or to speak without any intimidation, blatant or subtle. The presence of counsel in all the cases before us today would be the adequate protective device necessary to make the process of police interrogation conform to the dictates of the privilege. His presence would ensure that statements made in the government-established atmosphere are not the product of compulsion. It was in this manner that Escobedo explicated another facet of the pretrial privilege, noted in many of the court's prior decisions, the protection of rights at trial. That counsel is present when statements are taken from an individual during interrogation obviously enhances the integrity of the fact-finding processes in court. The presence of an attorney and the warnings delivered to the individual enable the defendant, under otherwise compelling circumstances, to tell his story without fear, effectively, and in a way that eliminates the evils in the interrogation process. Without the protections flowing from adequate warnings and the rights of counsel, quote, all the careful safeguards erected around the giving of testimony, whether by an accused or any other witness, would become empty formalities in a procedure where the most compelling possible evidence of guilt, a confession, would have already been obtained at the unsupervised pleasure of the police, close quote. That's the U.S. That's quoting the U.S. Supreme Court of Mapp v. Ohio, Justice Harlan dissenting. Okay, folks, that's the end of part one of four of our reading of Miranda v. Arizona, the reading of the first half of the majority opinion. In the next part, part two, we'll share with you the reading of the second half of the majority opinion in part two of four of our reading of Miranda and Arizona. I'm looking forward to sharing that with you. Until then, I remain Attorney Andrew Branca for the Law of Self-Defense. Stay safe.